Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's April 12th, 2015, and welcome to episode 98 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
The Retro Computing Roundtable is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. Today, I'm your host, Jack Nutting, and I'm joined by a roundtable. Our usual roundtable is today four-sided table, which is approximates a circle. We have with us, after a few weeks' absence, Earl Evans. Earl, how have you been doing?
Hey, Jack. It's great to be back. I'm doing well, actually. I had a nice vacation. My family took a Mexican cruise, and we stopped off at several waypoints along the West Coast and had a great time. But it's nice to be back in the saddle here and back in the round table or square table or whatever it is we have today.
Nice. Cruise sounds like a good time, good thing to do this time of year when it's all not that warm in all of our other climates. Except for one guy who's glad to be getting away from the warmth, Michael Mulhern. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. It's the start of autumn down here, so it's painting time for me. So not too hot, not too cold, just the perfect time for a paintbrush.
Nice. And as usual, from Boston, Paul Hagstrom. How you doing, Paul?
I'm doing well. This seems to be basically the first day of real, like, spring weather. So I immediately, you know, went into my office and plugged in my microphone. But yeah, it's there's a certain optimism that this kind of spring weather brings. So perhaps that will get me, you know, even more dedicated to just like old machines and getting stuff running.
Well, good.
And for you?
Oh, it's been actually had some nice weather in Stockholm. Yesterday actually felt like our first real spring day, and we sat outside most of the day and fired up the barbecue for the first time and had a good time. And then today it went back to raining as usual.
Excellent.
So, well, we have a lot to cover today, so let's get right into it. The first thing that I want to talk about is something that I've been doing more and more of. As I've been trying to sort of get actually good at 6502 assembly, I've been looking at more tools for ways to do this nowadays. Because one of the things that I like to do with old computers is program them, especially trying to be able to do things that I saw in my childhood and my teenagehood. You know, I ran a lot of software, I used a lot of software, but I didn't really know how to do any of these things. And I'm thinking that I can actually try and accomplish some of these things myself. Now, with modern computers, we can run editors and we can run emulators. We can do some things quite a bit more easily than we could have done before. So you can, you know, you can fire up a modern editor on a modern computer and launch things in an emulator, and you can share your source code on GitHub and all these things that are, it's all so much easier than anything would have been before. One of the tools I've been using lately is there's an Eclipse-based environment called Wudsn, W-U-D-S-N. And this is something that is, it's an Eclipse plugin that gives you 6502 assembly syntax highlighting, and gives you a bit of like a code structure overview, like a kind of an outline view of your code, and it lets you lets you code in using various assembler syntaxes and using various assembler binaries that you can install and run it with. This is primarily for Atari 8-bits, Atari 2600, Commodore 64, and what more? Maybe like there's an oddball one like the Nintendo NES, I think. So, it's quite cool, and I think the nature of this thing is that it's pretty extensible. So it's not at all out of the question that someone could take this and build in support for an Apple II emulator using the same kind of basic technology. And this has actually been something that I've found to be a really nice way to do things. And one of the cool things is that the guy behind this, his name is Peter Dell. I believe he is German. He's actually made what I found to be a nice little series of videos specifically about the Atari 8-bit. There seems to be 10 or so videos on YouTube where he's talking about using Wudson specifically to make some simple Atari programs to do some simple things, which for me has been really sort of eye-opening, because I find that I spent a lot of time kind of looking at books and trying to grasp how to sort of come to terms with some of these things. And here he kind of puts it in sort of simple programs that are just a few lines long that can demonstrate some of the concepts of that you'll need to tackle in this sort of software. So this is something that I've been having fun with, and I wanted to see what other kinds of things you guys might have been up to that along these lines that could be interesting to share. We can go in the same order we started with, I guess. How about you, Earl? You've been doing any sort of retro programming with modern tools lately?
Not lately. I did some for the last retro challenge that I participated in, and mostly it was just trying to use modern editors and such for doing the programming, but also a couple of conversion tools, for instance, some things to convert ASCII to Atari ASCII or ATASCII, so that I could get some things moved back and forth there. I have to say that some of the tools that I've tried, when they're not quite fully baked, it is a little off-putting for me. Maybe I'm just too demanding of a user in that sense. If I stub my toe too many times, then I kind of walk away. And you know, maybe a better approach is like what I did with one of the Commodore development IDEs recently, is I actually filed a bug report, and the developer both acknowledged it, thanked me, and committed to having that fixed up in a future release. So I think sometimes participating rather than just turning around and storming off is a better way to do it. That's a long way of saying I don't really have any favorite tools at the moment, and I would be interested in taking a look at this one that you found for Eclipse. Now, I don't want to start any IDE wars, but under normal circumstances, I'd rather be scourged and rolled in salt than have to play with Eclipse. But I'll definitely take a look at it for this purpose.
Yeah, I mean, I am definitely not an Eclipse user myself, if I can choose. But in some ways, this is such a simple use of it. So, I mean, you know, if you're dealing with a few files containing some assembly language code, you know, it's reasonable. The way I look at it is I'm not trying to use Eclipse as Eclipse in this case. I'm using Eclipse as a text editor that I can open up these files in. It happens to have some syntax highlighting. It happens to have some built-in shortcuts for launching an emulator. So it's sort of, I'm looking at it that way, because I don't have quite the same gut reaction you do against Eclipse, but it's definitely not anything that I have ever enjoyed much, including the time that I actually worked on building an Eclipse plugin for a while. That's a decade ago and another story. It was not much enjoyable. Michael, how about you?
Well, I think I'm a little bit more old school. I'm still basically doing my basic directly on the machine, or in most cases on the emulator. So I use CiderPress to extract the AppleSoft Basic file as a text file. I do my editing, so I use CiderPress for that. I use Notepad++ to do my editing. And then I just push it back and fire up the emulator. So all pretty, I'd say, manual. But the pipeline that I use was one that I wrote when I was back at university. I was using a full screen text editor to do the actual writing of the code. And then I'd use the execute command to push that text file back in as an AppleSoft program. So it would effectively write itself. And it would go through a parser. So there's no line numbers. You'd use labels, extra programming functions, and loops. And the big one that's missing from AppleSoft, there was no, you had if then, but there was no else. So I was able to make nested if then, else, structures. Okay. Which made programming just that little bit easier. And then my pipeline from that is that I would then run that code through a cruncher program, so all variable names got reduced, cut down on storage space, all the remarks and comments were removed, and then a final step, it would just fire it through a compiler so that you actually had a standalone binary. Not as good as assembler, but faster than AppleSoft in its native form. So I'm still using that pipeline, but I'm just starting it off outside the actual emulated environment. So cool. I've dabbled with CC65 and using various methods to get that automatically into a emulator image, but I still prefer coding either in BASIC. I find that that's what I was doing most of my work in at university and after university, and I'm just still doing it that way.
Interesting. So this this tool that you're talking about, where you have sort of kind of an extended version of BASIC that gives you some nicer structures, nicer control flow, and eliminates line numbers and things. Is this something that you came up with yourself, or is this something that has been around in other contexts? Or
originally took it out of a Nibble magazine and extended it quite extensively, but basically it's just a preprocessor. So the main reason I liked it when I found it is that it allowed me to gave me the idea that I could use a full screen text editor to write the program rather than using the built-in editor and typing in the line numbers, then bringing back that individual line number, the code that was on it, to edit it. So I was able to scroll up and down the screen and highlight blocks and move it around all through the keyboard. And I've been a code indenter from way back, so most people can pick up the code that I was writing in SBASIC, structured BASIC, on the Apple, and they compare it against code that I'm writing today, and the same style or conventions that I was using back then is what I'm still using now. And even when I'm doing my Perl programming, a lot of it still matches in quite similar to how I'm currently programming. So, hey, I'm still in the 80s.
Well, aren't we all? We've all got one foot in the 80s at least, maybe even a whole leg. Well, Paul, how about you?
Well, I always have these ideas that I'm going to do programming, but almost everything that I've done has been small enough scale that I have tended to do it just straight on the machine or the emulated machine. I want to try out some little thing in assembly language or whatever. I'll just type in the opcodes, and usually this is where I'm talking about 30, 40 byte programs.
Right.
But there is something that I've sort of installed this pipeline, that the current version of it is by Jeremy Rand, who extended something that Carrington did, and then Quinn Dunkey took that and made it one step better, which is basically just integrating CC65, which is the C compiler for 6502, and CA65, which is the assembler, that's sort of part of that same package, into Xcode, which is the IDE that you can get from Apple with for free with OS X, and basically just sets it up so that there's like a make file, and there's a template, it'll take your code, compile it, send it off to a disk image, and then open it in an emulator. So very cool thing, and I think I've gone through that pipeline once or twice, to see that it actually works. But I haven't, and I have ideas about things I want to write, but just so far I haven't played with it much. But my experience with using BASIC, at least on the Apple II, which is the one that I would primarily be doing this on, I am spoiled by the the future from then.
Yeah.
So it is the fact that I can only see something like 12. Basic lines on one screen before they're gone, and there's no scroll up, and it quickly becomes pretty frustrating to have to deal with the programming like it was done in the day. So I don't feel too nostalgic, I guess, about the sort of the bad parts of trying to program on the 40 by 24 screen.
Right.
And I think I would rather just move faster and have it be a little easier to get the program's actually running on the original machine. You know, once the program's actually there and done, you know, then I'll go back to the original machine.
Right. Yeah, I think this is in line with we talked a few episodes ago about this notion of are we cheating by using things that let us access data more quickly and easily through various hardware extensions and this sort of thing. And I think that we came to the conclusion there that we sort of were not, that we were sort of, you know, we were working around things that we would have happily had this work around 30 years ago. We wouldn't have, you know, 30 years ago, it would have just felt like it was something totally awesome. It wouldn't have felt like, oh man, now it got too easy. I think the same applies here. No one was, I think anybody who was used to working, writing basic programs on the Apple II or the Atari or the Commodore 64 will easily testify that, okay, having that little screen full of text at a time to deal with was not really optimal. And if you'd had a nicer way to edit your text in that time, you would have done so.
Here's my main argument for why we're not cheating on this. Because if you looked at the software houses of the day, they were doing this with the bigger computers that they had at their disposal.
Right.
I distinctly remember people with PDP-11s and people with other bigger machines would use those computers to do the editing and the compiling and then would push the results onto the smaller machines.
Yep.
So they were doing that. They didn't have the, you know, octa-core machines that we have today, but they were doing the same sort of thing. So now cross-platformer, you know, cross-development is certainly, that's retro.
Yep. Yeah, that's very much the case. I'm quite sure that most things that I've read about how what happened at Atari and stuff is that all of the actual software development was done on various kinds of mini computers and was then, you know, sort of cross-compiled or cross-assembled and pushed over to the Atari one way or another. I think this is a pretty standard way of doing it for anyone who could afford to do so.
Right, and you know, for some things like the 2600,
yeah,
that's pretty much what you do.
Yeah, there really wasn't much of a choice there. All right, cool. Well, thanks everybody. That was a good discussion. I got some new tips there, and especially Paul, you mentioned this your Apple II build pipeline for Xcode. That looks pretty cool. I think I might have to look at that and see if I can do something similar for the Atari 8-bits. Like an Atari 8-bit build pipeline for Xcode, because Xcode is the tool that I'm using most of the time for my real world modern development too.
Yeah, I think it probably is fairly doable. I mean, the underlying compilers for the same processor. Basically, I think the trick is getting it onto a disk image and then getting it into an appropriate emulator. I think Virtual 2, the Apple II emulation can do, can receive AppleScript events or whatever it is that allows it to all sort of happen in a line.
Okay, cool. All right, let's move along to some listener feedback. We've gotten a few items. We've actually gotten a number of items that we have sort of not taken care of, and some of those we're still not going to take care of right now today, but a few we are. So we got some feedback from Timo Edix. He sent us a bit of feedback about the Oldenburger Computer Museum. This is somewhere in Germany, in Oldenburg. I don't know where that is. But they have a pretty substantial exhibit of old computers and video games. And on their website, you can see a lot of interesting pictures. And they seem to have events there and just had a lot of cool stuff going on there. There are pictures, there are videos. I don't know if they have a video arcade section or if they have meetings where they go to some retro arcade. I haven't quite figured out what I'm seeing here in these party video or these party pictures they have. But it looks like a good time. Wonder if maybe I should take a trip to Oldenburg and check this thing out, because they seem to have a lot of cool stuff and it's all very hands-on. The idea being that they have exhibits where they'll have set up an Apple II with all you need and a Commodore PET with all you need to be able to actually sort of run some things and try things out and get a feel for what this old computer was like. It's very cool. Have you guys had a look at this at all?
Yeah, I had a look at it earlier in the week or last week, and yeah, I was quite impressed, and the videos as well. They've got a good set of videos up there on YouTube. But it's the important thing about it is it's hands-on, and I think that people who haven't played with our hardware from back in the 80s, this is a good opportunity for the younger programmers to get in there and really see where all this personal computing stuff started, and you know, see how it fits.
Yep. Yeah, I think it seems like a very cool initiative and something that would be fun to go check out some more. Okay, next item, we got more feedback from someone called Oscar Vermeulen. He has created a new sort of PDP 8/I kit built around a Raspberry Pi. Am I getting this right, guys? I don't remember the details. So I'm looking at it.
You could say, well, mm-hmm. it's a Pi DP. So
Pi DP. There you go.
Right.
It is. The interface got me. blinking lights and switches are. It's a great little case for a Raspberry Pi. His project pages are excellent, and detailing what's involved, parts you need, good shots, and even basically saying that he's taking expressions of interest for people who would like to get a complete kit. So looking at a moment...
Well, let me give an expression of interest.
Oh, I've already sent him back an email to say my interest is expressed. But yeah, $120 for all the rocker switches you could possibly need. It's even if you're not interested in actually getting the kit, and really, folks, you should, it is a very good example of website, blog, documenting a project. Great reading, strongly recommend it, and if you have even a little inkling of getting your own PDP, this would just be such a great way of having something very interesting on your work desk.
Oh yeah, this thing seems quite awesome. So in college I played with a PDP-8E that one of our instructors had brought in, and this looks like the same kind of thing, except, you know, probably 1/100th of the overall weight and size. So a bit more portable, a bit more easy to sort of actually put on your desk as opposed to putting in a giant rack next to your desk. So,
if he's actually able to make the kit for the amount of money that he's thinking, then I think that would be a fantastic deal. I actually looked at trying to build something like an Altair emulator, not really an emulator, but more like a prototype of a computer that had the LEDs and the toggle switches and a real instruction set, and that you could do things like this. I think I talked about this a couple of years ago, that I was thinking about doing this with my daughter. She was just getting into electronics, and it seemed like a fun project. Once you get all the LEDs and all the toggle switches and the front panel and the multiplexer circuits that you need to demultiplex all those switches and LEDs and say, it winds up costing a decent amount of money. I don't think 120, or even if it was a little more, I don't think it's out of line at all for this kit. So I hope it happens.
By the way, I think it just occurred to me that not all the listeners are looking at the thing. So, I'm not exactly sure how big it is. It looks like it maybe a foot wide, and then something like, I don't know, 6 to 8 inches tall, and it's like a little rectangular box. If you look at it straight on, it's the front panel of a PDP-8i. It's really nicely laid out and has spots for all the switches, and behind it is all the lights. And if you look at it from behind, it's basically just, that's it. You know, it's this flat facade, which is the front panel, and then the whole operation runs on SIMH running on the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, so if anyone out there can just hit pause on the podcast, go to our show notes and have a look at this. It is great.
Yep, awesome thing. All right, it's time to move along to the items of interest. And Earl, you up first with something that is related to this.
A little later model, kind of like the, what would you say, the younger brother of the PDP-8, the PDP-11. And there's a great story online. We'll, of course, have the link in the show notes, of a gentleman who refurbished a PDP-1104 and a DeckWriter printing terminal to the point where he could run a primitive operating system on it called CAPS-11. It turns out that CAPS-11 on the PDP-11 systems was a cassette-based operating system. And if you look on the blog, you'll see that there is a TU-60 cassette drive attached to this PDP-1104, and it uses the cassette tapes that we know and love. and allows you to run this somewhat limited operating system, but you can run BASIC on it. You can write a program, load and save from cassette. And when you run it, it takes a little while to actually compile and run because it's swapping in the interpreter, swapping out the editor. He does a very good job of explaining it on the blog. The thing that impressed me the most about this, and some of Tez's projects and other projects that you see around the web, I just look at these in awe and think, this is so amazing. Because he got this PDP-1104 and the cassette drive and immediately set out to say, what if this doesn't work? And first off started at the power supply, which didn't work and had a bad filtering capacitor, which he found a suitable replacement for, got that in there, dialed in the power supply, and got that working, producing the right voltages. Then there were logic problems with the PDP-1104 itself that he tracked down. One of the problems, I recall, was a bad dip switch, actually, on the board. So we're talking plugging in oscilloscope and logic analyzer and using all these diagnostic tools to debug this stuff that's decades old and actually resurrect it, bring it back to life. And then once you get all that stuff running, then there's a problem with the serial interface. And he solved that too. These things are staggering to me because it's so painstaking and such a labor of love. And all of this is so well documented on the blog page. You've got pictures and technical descriptions and step by step. This was broken. I found it this way, and then I did this to fix it. And in one case, he even had to create his own custom circuit because the circuit that he needed to make one of these pieces work wasn't even available anymore. I think it's a great read, and there's a nice YouTube video that shows the finished result with him loading the operating system, running a BASIC program, and having it come out on the printing deck terminal. Just fun. If you're a geek who either loves to restore things or wish you knew what it took to restore things, this is great.
Yep, the thing is pretty fantastic. And like I said, well documented and just a huge piece of electronic sleuthing work to get this thing working again. Really impressive that someone is both able and willing to take the time to do this and make it happen. Very, very mm-hmm. cool.
And he noted that it was a group effort that many people contribute to something like this, either schematics or documentation. One of the things he thanked Al of BitSavers for having all that documentation out there. There were some other folks that had helped him along the way, too. And that's the fun part, too, of being in the vintage retro computing community. There's so many people willing to lend a hand when you're doing something like this, but not to take away from the work he did, because like you say, it's just amazing. Yeah. So great site.
I'm quite impressed. I mean, everybody so far that has talked about this has said this, but it's documented fantastically. I mean, this took apparently like a year and a half to do. And it seems to me like once I got the video shot of it going, I would just like take a nap for 6 months. You know, I can't imagine still having the energy to do all this documentation. it's great. Even if nobody ever does this specific thing again, just sort of seeing the techniques that were used to if you have another sort of similar kind of thing you want to try, this is a good kind of like guide to a project that actually did end in success.
Yep. Very cool. All right, the next item is something that I have come across. This is an article entitled How to Turn Your Whole Car into a Video Game Simulator. This is from a website called Jalopnik that I have never come across before. But basically, the author of this is talking about that he is working on a piece for the Indianapolis Museum of Art, where basically he's going to have on a giant outdoor amphitheater, he's going to be displaying Pole Position, running on either an Atari 2600 or an Atari 400, and the controls for the game will be attached to an actual car sitting in front of the screen. So I believe the car that you're sitting in will not be in motion.
Very so the, short game.
So the car will be stationary, but the car will control the game. So basically use the controls of the car to control the game, which means that he's attached sensors to the to the foot controls in the car, the brake pedal and the gas pedal, and to the steering wheel. And he describes how he's hooked these things up. Basically, he's got some sort of tilt sensor controls that are attached to the steering wheel to basically just trigger the same thing as pushing the joystick left or right, and something attached to the pedals as well. And all of these are going through an interesting little device that was called Atari Lab, something that Atari sold to schools to try and get schools interested in showing kids how to connect devices to computers, to Atari computers specifically. So this thing played into the joystick ports, I guess, and you could connect different devices to it for sensing, I'm not really sure what. I remember hearing of this thing 30-plus years ago, but never saw one or even saw a picture of one before now. So there's some pictures showing how he's got the setup inside the car. In fact, it was actually the obligatory roll of duct tape sitting on top of the computer, which is a nice visual touch in the photo there. Anyway, it seems pretty cool. I'm not sure that I would actually do this project myself as far as actually turning a car into a video game controller, but it's a neat idea. And this is going to be something that's going to be on display at the museum in Indianapolis apparently this summer at some point. So if you're on your way past Indianapolis this summer, stop by and you can try and play pole position on a giant screen. He described that the size of the screen was such that each pixel is going to be roughly the size of like a business card. It should be a very gigantic, nice, pixely display in front of your immobile car. Next up, Michael, you have something interesting. You have a musical selection here.
Yes, I like retro music, and this one, you can't really get much retro than this. Matt Parker has been recording the sounds of 70 years of computing. So he's been at the National Museum of Computing, and he's been recording the computers, not quite doing an interview, I suppose, but making up a sound library of all the different machines, peripherals that are available and working. Some of this was made available at the Easter Bites at the museum. And there's also we'll have a link in the show notes to Matt's project webpage for this, earthkeptwarm.com, where he has a teaser for a musical composition. It is actually quite a pleasant listening experience, but he's building it up out of the sound bites that he's been recording, and I'm looking forward to it. I've purchased quite a few different CDs from various artists over time for retro-inspired music. And after listening to this teaser, this is another one which I'm quite interested in adding to my collection.
Cool.
So this will be a new take on the ambient genre.
Oh, yes. Yeah. There's all those ambience CDs for video gaming arcades, so why not one for retro computers?
Yeah. I assume this is somewhat more artistic than just like what it was like to be in the the mainframe.
Oh yeah,
printers going.
Yes, this one titled "The Imitation Archive." Yes, that's more artistic than immersive, but I don't know if I was able to access that sound library. I think I could get a little bit of ambience tracks going for downstairs in the 8-bit bunker. Turn nice. It into a data processing center.
There's a picture at the Tian Mok site of him standing there with the microphone pointed at the pointed at the little whatever they are. What are those? I think those are the little rotating counter tubes that I was that we were talking about last time.
Mm.
Anyway, it's a funny picture.
Yeah, it's the kind of you usually see someone pose with a mic like that. They're recording either the sound of a human or the sound of, they're trying to record a cricket in nature. Yeah, a babbling brook, something that you would not expect to be a giant wall of computer flashing thingies. That's the technical term for that, Paul.
Yep.
Computer flashing.
Sorry.
Let's get this straight. All right, cool. I think that the thing that makes me, I'm curious about is, I wonder if this contains any of sounds of like the classic 80s dot matrix printer that like can sound like it's tearing a hole through space and time. There's this I'm waiting for that to pop into some music somewhere. All right.
Wait, that's already in music. If you listen to some of the soundtrack music from the BBS documentary, it was done with dot matrix printers, as I recall. So, nice. But correct me if I'm wrong. Jason, yell at me if I'm wrong, but I think that's right.
Okay, cool. I'll have to go back and check that out again. We'll have a listen.
There are, of course, there's a whole like genre of YouTube videos that of you know, like whatever the Imperial March played on printers or disk drives.
I'll have to find that one. That was actually quite good. But yeah, dot matrix printers are nothing. I used to help the printer operators at the data center back when we had the large band printers. So that was more like thundering hammers rather than the noise of the dot matrix printer. So
Was that the kind of that would kind of like hammer out a whole row at a time?
Oh yes, so you'd have a metal band with the full alphabet, or for some of the high-speed printers, maybe it would have three or four, just the uppercase letters, special characters and numbers, and that band would basically be spinning around so fast in an endless loop, and the hammers coming up and going hammer to metal through ribbon onto the paper, and you know, literally printing hundreds of lines per minute. The fanfold paper was just roaring through, so you didn't want to get too close because you'd have one paper cut you'd never forget, and just the noise of them, even in the acoustic hoods, you could still really feel the noise coming through. And no, the reason I got up so close with these is that the printer operators would finish their shift around 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And us programmers, if we needed a listing, we needed to know how to operate these large printers so that we could get our listings. Again, there was the way that you did your debugging. Having, you know, maybe half an inch of 17 by 11 fanfold blue half line, and just going through line by line. All I can say is thank God I didn't have to do those programs with punch cards, but if you wanted your listing and you needed to do it.
All right, cool. Well, let's move along here. Paul, you've got something that I also saw this week, which was pretty amazing. Why don't you describe this to us?
Okay, so this is a thing that's you know, again, sort of made it around the media feeds. And the thing I'm talking about is a demo, basically, that was written for the IBM PC with a CGA card, so color graphics adapter, early card. And it was written as part of, I think, like some kind of a demo party. One of the things that they, I mean, sort of the primary thing that they often do is sort of try to push the hardware to do things that are sort of amazing, you know, so these are basically like ways programmers can show off. So this particular one that's been going around is called 8088 MPH. So if you think about sort of old IBM PC graphics, you can kind of just see in your mind, you know, the black and the white and the kind of like the cyan and the magenta, you know, you know, this terrible, terrible color set. And so what this, you know, what this demo managed to do is, you know, analyze the signals that are going through the CGA card in conjunction with understanding kind of how the NTSC signal works and how color is represented on the composite, output. And I think that's how this works, is that the CGA card has, you could connect it to a CGA monitor, but you have to, but for this to work, you send it out the NTSC composite output. And basically, by playing with the timing and understanding exactly how the color bursts and pulses work, this demo was able to get, I think it was what, like...
A thousand, they said, yeah.
Yeah, which, I mean, you know, it's the thing is supposed to do four, and it's... It's really, and there's actually quite a number of things to this demo that they're, you know, doing things with cycle timing and, you know, this sort of 2600 style, you know, racing the beam kind of stuff. It's really quite astounding when you think about this is basically running on a stock, you know, 1981 IBM PC with the like nearly worst graphics card it could have.
Right.
And one of the things that they are sort of the headline on this, the write-up of this, says, you know, 8088 MPH, we break all your emulators. because they're sort of proud of the fact that this is just so deep into the machine that the emulators just can't do it. Like, the claim is that no emulator can actually do this right. I know that this is also now a target, you know, so the emulator writers are trying to get this to work, and this is a great test case. So, but it really looks fantastic.
Yep, it's quite amazing. I think, you know, I've seen a lot of these kind of demos before, back in the 90s on the Amiga and stuff. And this is obviously not as advanced as what the Amiga could do, but this is so much advanced beyond what I ever imagined that an IBM PC with CGA graphics could do. So I think they said they're running on, they've used a couple of 5160s, which I say is equivalent to the IBM 5150, but it was easier to find actual machines to run on.
Well, it's the XT.
Okay.
Versus the PC.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, so, but apparently this should work on the original PC as well. That's what they're saying. And, yeah, so the video, the YouTube video, is apparently digitized from the, I guess, from the composite output, because since there's no emulator that can actually run this thing all the way through. So, yeah, it's very, very, very impressive. And also, not only the graphics, they were actually playing music on using the little sort of built-in click speaker, which, again, it doesn't sound anywhere near as advanced as, say, music in an Amiga demo or even music in a Commodore 64 demo, but pretty good for coming out of that little clicky speaker. So
I seriously have to drag out my XT to try this.
Yeah, download it and give it a try. Let us know how it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing that's you know, most mind-blowing about this is that this could have been written in 1981. It wasn't. But in 1981, you could have seen this if those bytes had been on a disk. And someone, I think someone mentioned on the, you know, on the one of the vintage computer lists, you know, the thought that, you know, part of the reason this had never been done, really, is just that the lifespan of the PC was relatively short. You know, like by the time someone would have, you know, actually sat down and figured out how to do this, the computers were much better. You know, so what's the point? You know, now it's an interesting kind of intellectual exercise.
Right. Yep, very cool. Again, it's one of these things that I find it amazing that people have the time and ability to do this sort of thing. It's very cool.
Maybe, actually, there's one other thing I wanted to mention was that there have been recently in the Apple II circles a sort of similar kind of, you know, set of demos being put out by a group called the French Touch. And so every once in a while, there's another one that comes out, and it does the same kind of, you know, the same kind of things that you just can't understand how are even possible. I mean, so we'll have a link to that in the show notes. They have, I don't know, half dozen things. I think the most recent one was called Crazy Cycles, and it's, you know, it's all basically cycle counting to get the screen to do things that you wouldn't think it could do. And if Ken were here, he would speak of documentaries about the demo scene and demo parties he's been at. Maybe he'll talk about those next time we have him here.
Cool. All right, let's move along here. Earl, you've got some news for us?
Well, I do, and I guess I'm kind of scooping you guys on this, right? Paul, aren't you the Apple guys? But this I say after having stolen this from one of the spare news items that Paul probably put in the show notes. Everybody is excited because the 27th Kansas Fest has opened for registration. It's going to be July 14th through Sunday, July 19th, 6 days and 5 nights of absolute Apple II bliss. Sessions, demos, announcements, contests, and camaraderie. Now, if you try to go to the site right this second as we speak, I think it's down. I'm trying to load it. Oh, no, they got the site back up. So, yay, 30 minutes ago it was down, but somebody was not asleep at the switch. So you can go there, you can find out all the deals on registration. So register early, register often. You want to go to Kansas Fest, you've heard us talk about it ad nauseum, so I don't have to repeat all of that, here just to say that it's a great opportunity to get together with like-minded retro people, listen to them talk in the day and snore in the night, and have a lot of fun.
Yeah. And cool. This year there's going to be a strong Atari contingent.
Yep, seems
there
like
is. Yeah, they're taking over. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's primarily an Apple II-focused event, but because it is, because many people who are interested in Apple IIs are also interested in other things, there's often things that are happening with other computers, and it does, the Atari Podcaster Brigade seems to be planning to descend. Also, maybe I should mention that just as a reminder, since they haven't yet happened, but will very shortly, the VCF East is going to happen next weekend as we're recording this now, April 17th to 19th, and then soon after VCF Southeast, May 2nd to 3rd.
And if I can dig up the link, I'll post it on the show notes. Make sure to check out the Guru Meditation video for the YouTube channel Guru Meditation, where they're showing all of their Amiga stuff that they are preparing to cart off to VCF East. Mm-hmm. It looks pretty exciting.
Cool. Sounds good. All right. Well, that's we've got the geek meetup situation covered there. I've got something that I wanted to mention. Our friends over at Antic, the Atari podcast, they've been doing a series of interviews the past several months. Maybe it's been almost 5-6 months. Maybe they've been doing a lot of interviews, interviewing people who worked for Atari or who worked for software companies who made Atari games or other software. Just been a huge range of really interesting stuff. And over the course of time, I felt like these things have gone from being just interesting to actually being kind of important, because they're really documenting a lot of, sort of what the computer industry looked like in the late 70s and early 80s, an interesting way. It's because these are people who obviously, we're all getting older, and most of these people are a little bit older than most of us on this podcast anyway. So, these are people who at some point their viewpoints are going to be gone, and it's interesting to sort of grab these opinions from what people talking about how things were and what things were like, and everything from, so the very latest episode that they have, they got Al Alcorn, who was Atari employee number 3. He was not one of the founders, but he was hired immediately. Essentially, he created the original Pong arcade game. He was lead engineer at Atari for several years, and he just talks about a lot of interesting stuff that went on there. If you've not been checking out Antic, you really should. Even if you're not interested in Atari specifically, there's just a lot of really great stuff in these interview podcasts. And again, it's people who've been working for Sierra Online and all kinds of software companies that we all know from back in the day who have done, many of these guys, they've done Atari software, they've done Apple software, they've done Commodore software, they've done a lot of interesting things and have a lot of great stuff to say. So, and one of the things that struck me about this as I was listening lately was it kind of highlighted this idea that we've had, back in the day when we talked about any kind of cross-platform development, you're either talking about developing in my case, typically C, maybe later in Java. Nowadays, people talk about cross-platform, they're almost always talking about the web. You're doing HTML, you're doing JavaScript. But what some of these interviews highlight is that in the 80s, people, if you're doing cross-platform software, that very often meant that you had a lot of your core functionality was just straight 6502 assembly. And you might write that on an Apple II and then port that to the Commodore 64 and port that to the Atari 800, or, vice versa. It could be different directions on that. But like sort of the way to do cross-platform was to have a shared set of assembly code and then wrap that in what you needed to actually do the I/O for each device. And we've kind of, nowadays, when cross-platform means, okay, we want to support both iPhone and Android, that's a lot of what it is these days. And then people go with web frameworks and it's JavaScript. And it's sort of like, whereas, cross-platform in the old days meant one thing, nowadays what we're talking about is almost like stuff that is above and beyond the layer of platform. It's almost like a meta-platform when you're dealing with JavaScript. So, anyway, I've been rambling enough here. Forget about all that. Go check out Antic Podcast when you're done listening to us, of course. Have you guys heard any of these interviews lately?
Yeah, I've been mostly keeping up. I think I'm still a couple behind, but I saw the Al Alcorn one pop into the feed, and I had the same kind of thought. It's like, Wow. It has kind of graduated to a level of serious sort of documenting, you know, documentary making, I suppose, is kind of what I was aiming for there. But you know, it is these are people that you do want to talk to, you do want to hear from, that you might not forever be able to hear from them. And they've been doing a fantastic job at getting people to talk to them. And I think, you know, as that list of people they've interviewed increases, the harder people to get are more willing to take them seriously too. So, it's definitely very interesting. I don't have any particular, background with Atari, but it's interesting regardless of that.
And I think the Antic folks have kind of realized that too. You hear them talking on the podcast about the interviews, and I think they came to the same conclusion you guys did, that at some point they turned the corner from this is entertaining and this is kind of fun for our platform of interest to, oh my gosh, we're preserving history. And they have a background of that too. I mean, I think specifically I mentioned Kevin and his archiving of the Atari magazines and the Atari books.
Right.
So definitely a heart to preserve history, and in this audio form, it's fantastic. So kudos, guys. Keep it up.
Yep. All right. Next up, Michael, you have a little bit of touring-based memorabilia.
Yes, if you've got a lazy $1 million lying around, that's the guide price for an Alan Turing notebook. Now, I'll put links into the Bonham auction, and that's happening very soon. But one of the things that has popped up about it is there's a bit of controversy over the fact that this notebook was granted an export license by the UK government. And one of the concerns, and rightly so, is that this notebook could get bought up by a private collector, and the world will basically not see it again for a long time. Researchers, historians will lose the opportunity to gain access to this book. But go to the Bonhams website. There's some good shots of the notebook itself, and it is an interesting piece of early computing mathematics history. And what some people won't realize that there is actually still quite a lot of Alan Turing's work which is not yet unclassified. So it's known that there is still a lot of his stuff that is classified at various levels within the UK government and military archives, and it's always good to find something by probably one of the greatest computing people that was out in the 40s and 50s. The man was brilliant.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a national treasure. I would be concerned too if I were them that could actually leave the country, get stuck in a corner somewhere where no one would have access to it.
What I wonder is who is the seller, who actually owns this right now?
It went into a private collection.
Okay.
And this is what happens when something does get into a private collection. I'm not quite sure exactly how he got it. I believe that he was a confidant of Turing, and he basically had that notebook. It didn't get collected up with other materials and put away in the government archives. But it's only something that's sort of like it's come out of effectively, I believe, an estate sale. Now, if it goes into another private collection, in all likelihood, it's very limiting on the avenues to get hold of it, especially if it's a private buyer who doesn't really make themselves known. It's going to be a lot more difficult for archivists to actually request permission to actually view it in any situation.
Right. Very interesting. Well, hopefully someone who is a benevolent benefactor will step in and willing to buy this and actually make it available to people. I mean, obviously, the great thing is if someone could actually just digitize this in some form. And I guess that, you know, I guess the current concern about it disappearing is based on presumably that the current owner does not want to do that. It would be nice to see what happens with this. Hopefully something good, so the world can actually get some benefit from this and use this.
I would think that there have got to be some museums that have this in their sights, but still there is a risk that a museum won't get it. And even a museum might put it in a back room.
We are talking about somebody with deep pockets for a 56-page notebook, so...
Yeah, pretty pricey for most museums, I would say, I would guess. Not a lot of bang for your buck in the sense of just the number of pages.
Right.
All right, moving on. Paul, you've got something else interesting here. Why don't you tell us about this other take on an Apple Watch?
Right, so for those who have not been paying attention to the modern computing world or computing-related world, Apple has, maybe even today, they're shipping the Apple Watch, and so whatever iOS device type thing that is going to change the world again or whatever. But someone put Instructables put together a little description of how you can build an Apple II watch, which is fairly amusing little thing. It has a sort of Apple II styling, and it will display something on the screen that has kind of an Apple II flavor to it. It is not emulating anything, but it does look pretty cool. That sort of goes through the steps on like how this person built the parts, made little like miniature floppy disks that would fit into it, and it is running on Teensy, I think, that actually will show something interactive on the screen, but it's not, it's still a little bit of a slideshow, basically. It's not actually emulating anything. You can't run your Apple II games on it, but it'll look sort of like an Apple II booting and that sort of thing. It's pretty humorous. And kind of related to that, I also, there's another thing that at least I came across recently. I'm not sure if it's that recent. Maybe it's new, but there's a blog post about turning the Arduino Uno into an Apple II, and this one is emulating. So this blog post sort of goes through and talks about sort of how you can take the architecture of the Apple II and what the limitations are of the Uno, and just sort of how he managed to get this interfaced so that converting the keyboard input over a PS2 connector. And I think actually the Arduino Uno has, I read it in here and I don't remember, but it's a very small amount of RAM.
Yeah, I think it's a 32K for the Uno. So
okay,
you've got a 32K device, and if he's doing a basic Apple II, there's 48K. So I'd say the free RAM available might be just a tad less than what most Apple II programmers are used to.
Right. Yeah, that's true. It's a little bit less, even taking into account the ROM, and I forget exactly what was done here. But I would not mind actually trying to just redo this project, follow along, and just sort of get my hands dirty trying to work with essentially the architecture of a computer of that era at that deep of a level. I think that'd be sort of a neat thing to do. Maybe even trying to figure it out myself, but having this to look at when I get stuck. So anyway, it's interesting to look at. You can try it if you want. And that's it for, I think, this little segment of build-it-yourself stuff.
All right, cool. Thanks. It's like some fun projects to mess around with if you have some spare time and good fingers for dealing with tiny, tiny bits of things.
Yeah.
It seems like some very tiny, tiny, itty-bitty stuff there. All right, that's it for our news segment. It's time for a commercial break.
Why? Get the why. This is a perfect example of how Atari home computers are making learning fun. Stacy's learning touch typing by playing Typo Attack. She's protecting her letters from these mean little typos by pressing the right keys at the right time. Get the I. Just by playing this game, she could become a real typist.
Wanna try?
I thought she'd never ask.
Get the R, T, R, R, hit it.
Where is it?
And we're back. So, moving into the final stretch of today's podcast, look at some eBay auctions. But before we get to the general auctions, I want to present my retro computing gift idea. This is something that everyone loves coffee mugs. Am I right? Who does not love coffee mugs? And everyone loves the pictures of classic computer keyboards. Well, here we go. This coffee mug has a bunch of classic computer keyboards right on it. It's beautiful. So, and the main thing, the first thing that caught my eye was actually an Atari 400, which was my first computer, and so I'm pretty psyched about that. I also recognize actually an Atari ST and so a Commodore VIC-20, and then maybe some Sinclair things, and I'm not sure what all. You can't, unfortunately, it doesn't show us the whole thing. Oh, it does. If I have to scroll down. Heck, there's an Atari 800 there as well. I see an Apple IIe, maybe. I'm not quite sure. I see a Coco. I see a lot of stuff. And these can be personalized with names and slogans and all sorts of things. So it's basically these kind of, it's kind of a very modern promotional mug type thing. Pretty cheap. £6 plus shipping. So that's my pick for a nice computing gift idea. But let's move along to other eBay auctions. Earl, when
now hold on there, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think you just cost me $20, is all I'm saying. Because mug really is beautiful.
Yeah, I think I wanted to just add, too, that this... So I think in the past we've seen things that are sort of like, you know, like the Sinclair keyboard around a mug or whatever. But I like this one because it actually does have a lot of keyboards on it. I mean, you know, that this for the Retro Computing Roundtable, people who are into all of these, you know, you can sort of challenge people to identify them all, and you know, it's a fun little task to look at it and say, oh, that's an Amstrad, oh, that's a, you know.
Yep.
So, I like it.
Yep. Yeah, it seems like a very cool thing. I might have to buy several.
Yeah. I've bookmarked it, and
I like that you can get slogans. You can put your customized name or message on the top.
That's what I'm waiting for.
Yeah, so we should get one that says something like, you know, retro compute.
Yes. All right. Well, let's move along to the other eBay auctions. Earl, why don't you start us off? What do you got for us today?
I will. Well, I have a couple things, but one I'll just mention briefly because I guess you guys already talked about it on a previous RCR that I missed while I was on vacation. But kind of harkening back to the PDP-11 story of earlier, turns out that in the Soviet Union, PDP-11, or a chip that was binary compatible with it, was a popular platform for home computers. Don't really remember seeing that at all here in the States, except there was a Heathkit computer, as I recall, that had a PDP-11 brain. But mostly, yeah, our home computers were Z80 or 6502 or something like that, and later Motorola 68000-based machines. But this Electronica, particularly this model BK0010-01, was a PDP-11 that spoke BASIC and I think also another language called Focal, and just struck me as really interesting and not that terribly expensive given what it was. So we'll have the link again for that. But my main auction this time is Microsoft Fox Pro for MS-DOS. And I believe this was the last version that they made of Fox Pro for MS-DOS. You guys have heard me talk before. I dealt a lot in the 80s with business software. And so while a bunch, thousands, honestly, of games are preserved and the legacy of them are preserved on our home platforms, it seems like the business software doesn't get a lot of love because, you know, kind of boring compared to shooting up aliens or going on a fantasy adventure. But I was big into database programming, so something like this Microsoft Fox Pro would be really interesting to me. It seems like in a lot of cases the running price for some of these is between 50 and 100, depending. Sometimes you can find them cheaper. Occasionally I've found them for free that someone is giving away. But $70 doesn't seem outrageous for me if this is complete like they say, and would be fun to just light it up and actually see the Fox Pro interface up and running again. So that's my pick.
Cool.
Yeah, I definitely have a soft spot in my heart for Fox. I'm just sort of looking up at my shelves here, and I have a couple of versions of Fox Base and a couple of versions of Fox Pro, and I haven't actually used them recently, but I sort of sunk enough of my life into it earlier that I kind of, it's comforting to have them here still. The history of the company and that product is also a pretty interesting one too.
Yeah, I like picking up the early versions of software. Just recently, I picked up a floppy disk version of Visio, which originally, this is the original version of Visio for Windows 3.1 and higher by Shapeware, even before they changed their name to Visio Corp, which was the predated Microsoft buying them out. So I just love getting the early versions of software that that we're using, be they databases or project planning, all of that kind of stuff that we're using almost on a day-to-day basis. I just love going back to their original releases where I can.
I still haven't torn the shrink wrap off my Clipper Summer 87 that I got. I need to channel the spirit of Carrington here to just, like, do it. Break that shrink wrap. Smell the 80s.
To the extent that I do that, I always kind of want to set up some way to record the moment. You know, like some video of, you know, what it looked like before and how what order everything came out and that sort of thing.
I'll have a mass spectrometer nearby so you can actually sample that 80s air as it does physically come out of the box.
Right. See if it actually was different.
It was.
All right. Well, this is an interesting item. I think the only thing I want to point out is that we should warn potential buyers that clearly on the top of the box it says promotional sample, not for resale. So just be careful. You don't want to get in trouble buying something that is not for resale.
Breaking the law, breaking the law.
Actually, just to, you know, because I know we're trying to get away from this auction and move to the next one, but the thing about, you know, this may be true of a lot of business software, but I noticed this on Fox stuff too, that there are a lot of different versions. You know, so there's like a LAN version, and there's a single user version, and a multi user version, and if you're going to write a program that will run without you know, with being within the environment, then you need to get the distribution kit and all this stuff. So there is actually a lot to know if you want to be sort of serious about using this. You know, if you're going to get a multi-user version or a single-user version, you want to know that that's going to meet your needs. And it's very tricky to it's not easy to find out what you need, and it's not easy to find out in an auction what it is. But anyway, whatever. It's a deep hole.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move along here. I've got the next item. This is a set of vintage retro computer bookends. They are solid metal, and they are really cool. And I know because it says in the description, solid metal, really cool. It also says IBM Apple Mac, which when I look at this, I don't see anything looking like an Apple product or a Mac of any kind. But it does kind of resemble an IBM PC. Basically, it's a small metal, solid metal bookend. Really cool, and it's shaped like an 80s computer-ish. Like you see, it's like a desktop computer with a monitor on top showing what looks like some sort of graph and a keyboard in front of it. Costs $40 right now. Shipping seems pretty high right now. I guess this thing is probably pretty heavy. I don't see it saying how heavy it is, but I mean it's bookends, right? It's got to be heavy to keep books from falling over. It says that it is 5 inches high. 5 inches across, roughly 3 3/4 inches deep. So it's a sizable bookend. So there you go.
Cool.
Did I mention it's really cool?
Well, being made out of metal, it probably is cool to the touch.
Yeah.
I'm thinking.
Really cool.
Yeah, it must be cool. It's been documented.
All right. Michael, what have you got? I saw you had some metal here also.
Yes, so into some heavy metal here. It's a vintage 1980s Atari brass belt buckle, and it's rare. It says so in the eBay listing. But I have in the past had a range of belt buckles. Never one like this. I suppose it's something which hasn't continued on past the 80s and the 90s. But when I saw this one, it was nice. So if you're after a not quite understated brass belt buckle, this one's for you. And of course, when you get your jeans on and your big brass belt buckle. You're going to have to grab your Atari cap as you leave the house. So if you're going to look the part, and of course you've already selected the appropriate t-shirt and jacket from the wardrobe. But the main one of my auction picks, the reason for these two, is here's a Atari promotional pin for, in my opinion, the best arcade game ever, Battlezone.
Yeah, this is cool. And I love Battlezone also. We can both join the Battlezone fan club if such a thing exists.
Yeah.
Battlezone 8, probably more quarters than Gorf, although it was probably close. Because Gorf was at my college, what do they call it, the student union, and Battlezone was not. So Gorf might win on the quarters, just, you know, raw spendage kind of thing. But I like Battlezone.
Yeah, so between Battlezone and Galaga, that ate a lot of my money. But Battlezone, yeah, I won't say I was ever good at it, but I thoroughly enjoyed being bad at it.
Which actually is kind of, it's kind of the inverse of Gorf, because even if you're good at Gorf, you felt bad about it. It was the feel bad hit of 1982, or whatever.
Well, it taunted you.
Yes, it taunted, it taunted you
the whole game.
Exactly. The farther you got, the more it taunted you. All right, Paul. You've got some stuff here as well. What do you have for us today?
Yep. Okay, so the first thing I came across was something called Commodore Power Monitor. And this is apparently, I think this is a new product, but I haven't ever seen anything quite like this before. And maybe those who deal with Commodores more often will have. But this is a little device you plug into the user port, I think, that will basically check the power levels to see if they are what they should be, and it has various little indicators to tell you if one of the power lines is not what it should be. So it'll warn if the 5-volt is too high, and it'll warn on ripple voltage. And apparently, the idea is that the Commodore power supplies are relatively prone to fail in various ways, and this is supposed to be a kind of warning that, you know, you might want to get a different power supply. I thought it was kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, the old 64 power supplies really sucked. And when the power supply goes, it could take your whole computer with it, which is, you know, double the fun. So, of course, if you're spending $20 on this device plus shipping, I wonder then how much more you would have to spend to just get a newer aftermarket power supply and not have to worry about it at all. But still, I can see the benefit of this.
And it's kind of a, I mean, it's sort of a cool idea. It's true that, no, I agree. I'm not sure that I would get this instead of getting a new power supply or just getting, you know, another Commodore 64. But, yeah, it's still, I hadn't seen anything quite like this for any other platform either. The other two things I had, one, you know, I'll put in the show notes are, I can go through relatively quickly. One is there's an IBM 5155, which is the luggable PC. I guess we this comes up, you know, every other episode or so, but it's PC XT in a luggable case. And what caught my attention is that it works, and the current bid is $1.25. actually, now that I'm looking at this, it's coming from, it's in Anchorage, Alaska. And if the auction stopped right now and I bid and, you know, won it at its current bid, it would be at less than $5. So I think the shipping is being wildly underestimated on this. nevertheless, it's a pretty cool computer being sold for whatever the market will take, basically. So that's always kind of refreshing.
Yeah, see, the seller wrote at the bottom of the thing that says he anticipates the shipping weight will be 35 pounds. So that's gonna cost you something.
Yeah. Not the $4 that apparently it's listed at shipping now. But still, I mean, these things often go for a fair amount. You know, like what I mean by that is a high amount.
Right.
But, and then the last one I wanted to mention was I just saw a listing that, you know, again, seemed relatively reasonable for a Amdek Color 1 monitor. I just wanted to mention this. I think the world in general has a fair amount of respect and nostalgia for these monitors. I might be wrong because this is the one I grew up with, so it may just be me. But I really like this monitor. This was, and I think it was a common monitor for a lot of the different computer platforms, but it worked on the Apple II that I had. And it really sort of sharp color. It's a big, heavy thing, but it worked very nice. So I don't know. Take a look at the auction if you want to remind yourself of what the monitor looks like. And it's, you know, monitors are heavy. They're heavy to ship. I think this one, for me, would be, it's pushing like $85 or something if I were to buy it now at the shipping, or at the buy it now price with the shipping cost. But it's it might have been worth it if I didn't already have one.
Right. Cool. All right. Thanks, guys. This is a good bunch of stuff here to look at and think about and probably not buy. But that belt buckle, man, I might have to think about that. All right, wrapping up here. We don't have much to add, anybody, I don't think. Michael, you had something you want to say. You wanted to mention OzKFest here.
Yes, I'm heading off to OzKFest next weekend. So that's the 17th to the 19th of April. And that's just going to be a smallish gathering, 20-something Apple II enthusiasts here in Australia. So we're all heading into Melbourne. And I'll be giving a couple of presentations there, and one of them is I'm going to be doing a opening of three shrink wrap games, two Avalon Hill games, and actually they're all Avalon Hill games, and I'm basically going to run a bit of a raffle guessing competition on that, so all of the attendees will basically give a count and a list of what they believe is inside the boxes, and the person who gets the closest guess will receive a book.
So that's like a, you know, count how many little cardboard markers are.
How many individual items? So you know, a bag of things is one item. You know, disc and sleeve is one item. So you know, some of these games have got you know, mail back cards and registration cards and other bits and pieces. And I just thought a little bit of fun. And as I said, the person who guesses most closely, I'll have to figure out some kind of count back in the event that two or more people get it, but they'll win a copy of the WozPack.
Cool. All right, great. Well, have fun. I'm sure you will, without me even telling you to. But just in case you forget, have fun.
Yeah. And just for something different, I'm also taking along my VZ200 and VZ300 machines, just so that there's a little bit of non-Apple hardware there. So they're two Australian computers from the similar vintage, so Z80-based machines. So I thought I'd just bring that along so that the other Apple II guys can compare their machines to others that were around in the day.
The VZ200, that is the VTEC Laser 200.
Yes,
that
is. Oh, that's right. You had a VTEC 200 as your eBay pick. That's right. Yeah, the VZ200 is that, and then the VZ300. Well, obviously, no one gets any prizes for guessing what that one is from VTEC. But I've got those the 300's in original packaging, so I'm just going to pack that up with the other retro stuff that I'm taking down with me. And as I said, just so that we have another computer of the day. And I've organized with another attendee. He's going to bring a Dick Smith CAT, which is a 6502 machine that came with an Apple compatibility cartridge. So to make it operate the same as a Apple II Plus. But without that cartridge, it's just another 6502-based personal computer from the 80s. Very nice machine.
Cool. All right. Sounds like good stuff going on there. Is that, by the way, is that event still open in case people might hear this in the last minute say, yeah, man, I'm going to book my ticket to Australia. I'm going.
Yes. Yeah. I'll make sure there's a link to the site. Registration details are on there.
All right.
So, yeah.
All right. Great. Well, I think that's it for this show. You will find show notes for all RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in our forums at vintage-computer.com/vcforum. You should follow RCR on Twitter @RCRPodcast. We love feedback in our email which you can send to feedback@ourshare.podcast.com, and we may deal with it at some future date if we get around to it, which we try to do. We are a member of the Throwback Network, which you'll find at throwbacknetwork.net, and find us and lots of other great retro-oriented podcasts. And please write a review on iTunes and give us a nice chunk of stars, preferably 5 or more. If you can manage to do more than 5, do it. Because that's the way that we find more people to listen to our show. The more stars we have, the better everything is. So, until next time, Retro Compute! It's a place of learning.